So I'll give Tim a brief introduction. I've had the privilege of knowing Tim now for many years, and he's
It's
been,
mutual. It's mutual. Yeah.
And I mean, he's been kind of like a mentor, friend, learned a lot.
We love pizza.
Yes,
Yeah.
yes, I remember. She was very small back then.
Remember.
So Tim is an entrepreneur, investor. Some of you might recognize him as the first winner of The Apprentice. I think we have definitely a super fan there. And now he's also the co-host of the show, sitting alongside Lord Sugar. So I thought it would be interesting. This morning I was just thinking about what could be most helpful to the young people who are here today. And there's a couple of things, key themes that I think would be interesting to explore. One is like just the early years in your life, your background, and how that's kind of shaped basically who you are and how you think. Also AI. We can't go a day.
I'll
The AI
be
expert right there.
watched. I'll be watched.
So Alex Jordan can fact check us. So I'd love to talk a bit about AI and how you see that shaping like the future of work, and particularly what you would be doing if you were a young person graduating today or even early in your career. And then we can talk about The Apprentice, because I think people here are naturally curious about that.
Forget it, it's boring. Don't worry about
Yeah,
it.
we want to hear the behind the scenes. So,
Turn the camera off and I'll tell you.
And then if we get if time permits at the end, let's open it up for Q&A. Does that sound good?
Could I be slightly annoying? Because I'd like it if we spent more time with the Q&A piece.
Me too.
Because I'm really honoured and privileged to be in this space. So thank you. Because who studied economics? A couple of you said economics. Yeah, my apprentice super fan. I like him. I'm watching Nick. Right, opportunity cost. It's one of the best and most important concepts in life. I think you could be anywhere doing anything, but you've chosen to be here, right? And I don't take that for granted, because at the moment there's lots of distractions with time and where you could spend a lot of energy. I would hope that by the end of the conversation that we find more commonality in our experiences, because I'm not some super dude or whatever. I have blood in my veins. I spend
we
far
all
too
bleed
much.
The same, right?
We all bleed the same, right? So I want to find a commonality of conversation. I want to find a strand that keeps us all together, rather than it be, oh, let's listen to Tim. I want to hear as much from you as I can hopefully share on the other side. But this is your conversation, so it's your time. So if you want to hear me talk about The Apprentice, we can spend all day talking about that. I know Nick will be happy, but everyone might be really bored, right? So I would hope that there would be more interesting things to speak about, given what's happening in the world on a local and geopolitical scenarios. I would hope we could have some interesting conversations.
Yeah.
Does that make sense?
Yeah, 100%.
Is that fair with you? Because it's your time. Cool. Yeah. We can speak about the... We definitely will get the apprentices in as well. We definitely will.
Great. So I think it will be interesting to start a bit, give people a bit of background on maybe like the early years in your life. You grew up in East London, and that has, I mean, East London has changed a lot, and some of the Netherhall lads here know how much I love Canary Wharf. But what was it like kind of back then? What are some of the, I guess, lessons you learned that has shaped the way you think about hard work, resilience, kind of perseverance? What were the kind of early years, critical moments?
I grew up in Stratford, East London, before the Olympics was there. So it's not as cool as it is now. It was rubbish. Stratford was crap. It was terrible. There was not quite abject poverty, because I've travelled around the world, but not a lot of people had a lot of stuff. My specific environment was interesting. My mum's from Jamaica, from the Caribbean, and came over here just after the main Windrush generation who came through. But she came as a single parent, an individual who then had three children in a single parent household. So growing up, resources weren't abundant. We didn't have a lot of stuff, but we had a lot of love. And we had church. No, we had comics and church.
Yeah.
Comics and church were the big things forming us. But as I was growing up, I realised there wasn't an awful lot of love in my house. And not that my mum was a bad mother, but love was a luxury that was expensive because mum had to go out and get the resources to look after three young children. So I didn't grow up in an environment where I was told I was loved. I was told things I had to do. So I've always measured myself as a result of that by accolades or getting things, because that's the way that we were measured or rewarded. So mum's mantras when we were growing up were, this is my house, these are my rules. Your parents might have said that to you many a time. If you don't like it, there's the door. You couldn't get anywhere near the door because she'd chase you. So you never quite made it that far. But it was more so, all of those things were because she was sacrificing to make sure that her children had more than what she had. Mm. Because she didn't want us to grow up as just statistics. She didn't want us to grow up as stereotypical young black children in East London and be subject to all the stereotypes that came with those things. And as a result, I spent so much time trying to be what she wanted me to be. Mm. As the biggest thing for her was to get qualifications.
Yeah.
It was to get a degree because she didn't have the chance to go to school. Not because she was stupid. My mum's incredibly intelligent. She is an entrepreneur, but she didn't call herself an entrepreneur because it wasn't the cool thing to say, right? She made ends meet. Her responsibility was to go and get the resources to sell clothes so she could. She was a wonderful seamstress. She could sit at a little Singer sewing machine and make clothes. So anything you were wearing, your wonderful jacket, your suit, she could make it without a pattern. She had a pair of scissors, material and thread, and she could make it. So she used to sell clothes to neighbours or curtains, whatever it might be. She would sell those to people that were in our area. In addition to that, she was a wonderful cook. Like, the one thing we never, ever ever missed in our house with food. That's why I loved that you started today with a conversation around food, because it's a bonding thing, right? Yeah, and it was the essentials that we had. I was never hungry. Sometimes I was cold, but never hungry. And if you were cold, mum said, put more clothes on, shut up, moaning, put more clothes on, right? But food was always important. So she had the ability to cook wonderful dishes. My mum should have had a business selling cakes, because she used to do the old traditional Jamaican thing of soaking fruit in alcohol, rum in our household forever. I'm not an alcoholic, I promise you. Fruit in rum barrels, old sweet bottles full of fruit and leave them forever and then liquidize them and put them into cakes. So her fruit cakes were unbelievable. They were the most moist, beautiful things. But after eating the cake, you couldn't drive home because you were probably drunk and stuff. But she should have had a business which she floated on the stock market called Curtains and Cakes. Yeah. She should have, because she was so good at it.
Yeah.
But she didn't understand marketing. She didn't understand sales. She didn't understand all that. All she understood is, I've got three kids, I need to find money. So as well as working for the council, looking after people in the care industry, she did those things to make money. So seeing her sacrifice all those things for me, all I had to do in her mind was just get a good education.
Yep.
Because she believed, in terms of the social mobility ladder that everybody is trying to climb, education was the pathway to success. And because she couldn't go to school in the small parish in Jamaica where she grew up, not because she was stupid, because in order to get to the nearest school, she had to get a taxi there, and the taxi driver didn't just want money to take her there, so she wasn't going to sacrifice herself, so she decided to stay on the farm. But as a result, she was adamant her children were going to get good qualifications. And I used to hate my mum talking about education because I'm like, yeah, but mum, you don't do this education stuff. Why are you forcing me to do it, right? But she was trying to impart what she didn't have onto me so that we would be better. And although I kind of listened to some of the things that she was saying, I spent most of my year 9 now at school because they changed the numbers. So I was about 13 or 14 truanting from school. I couldn't stand school. So this image you see on me of the television is this lovely boy in a suit. Yeah. Rubbish. Because I was bored by education. I hated school. I hated being told what to do. I was sitting in classrooms looking at teachers, thinking, you can't tell me anything.
Yeah.
Like,
did you have ADHD?
Do you know what? Both of my children have now been diagnosed. Yeah. I haven't been diagnosed. I know categorically I have ADHD.
Yeah.
I know you can call it whatever you want it, but I know I have it.
Right.
But I don't care.
Yeah.
Because I've used it to my advantage.
Yeah.
There's a very interesting thing, right? Your environment is half of the battle. So in a school education system, which told you to sit down, be quiet, listen to one person, not talk out of line, I could not thrive because I don't work in that kind of environment. All the things, I got expelled from school. I was in detention for several months.
Excluded, right?
Like, I was excluded from school. So you as my headmaster, you would have hated me, right? You would have hated me.
We would have spent a lot of time together.
We would have become intimate friends, shall we say, right? I remember for 6 months of the year of my year nine, I sat outside the headmaster's office on a single desk, and teachers used to come by and flick my ear and laugh and throw paper on my desk and all that stuff, until there was a young Irish teacher, youngest teacher in the school, who was a beautiful Catholic man, who said, "Tim, I'm going to take you under my wing." Literally, he said, "I'm going to look after you." He said, "I'm going to teach you how you can navigate this power structure of an institution so it works for you." And he took a huge risk. Mr. Murphy.
Okay.
He runs a college now in Ireland. And he saved me from the frustrations of education, because I was at the point where I was like, forget this. And, you know, they talk about sliding door moments. That was the sliding door moment for me. If I didn't have that man, I would have easily been incarcerated or worse. Of the 32 children in my form class, we did this calculation just 2 weeks ago. Only 7 of us made it out without a prison record or were still alive.
Wow.
32 children. It's nuts. It's nuts. So when I hear about your degrees or your opportunities and the stuff, I'm so thankful that you have that because of how important a gift it was. But that environment worked for you.
Sure.
It didn't work for me.
Yeah.
Don't get me wrong. After I was excluded and brought back in by this teacher, the Jamaican discipline for my mother was inflicted. If you don't know what it means, there were about 3 or 4 weeks I couldn't sit down properly because of the discipline that was inflicted. But I needed that because I needed to understand how serious it was, that intervention that was given to me. I didn't really understand it. At the end of it, I got all my GCSEs. I went to university. I was the first Campbell to get a degree. It was so long ago, my mum faxed it to everybody in Jamaica. Most of you don't even know what a fax machine is, do you? Do you know what I mean? You've never seen one. But essentially, that's how important it was in my life. And because my mum was praying over me and she wanted me to do well, I think I understood her way of showing love was to facilitate that I could be have the opportunities that she didn't have. So I eventually did all that, went to university, got my first job, left home, bought a flat, met my now wife when I was 20.
Wow.
Just before my 20th birthday. And we now have 2 beautiful children.
Amazing.
And we've been together forever since. So it was an interesting start, but your environment shapes you. And we should never take for granted how blessed we are to be here, because there's lots of people who would give their proverbial left and right hands to be in the same position.
Definitely. What I find so interesting about that is that, and many people here won't know this, but Tim ended up is the chair of governors at the same school he was excluded from. So
it's
come full circle for you.
So I've been a governor at St. Bonaventure's, my old school now, for...
Great school, by the way.
You would say that, we're biased, isn't it? For 15 years now. And one of my callings, my duties, is to find ways that I can give back, so I can find somebody who was maybe like me or struggling like I was, to find how they fitted within a system and help them navigate that environment, right? Whenever you get to wherever your destinies take you, please never forget the pathway that you've taken. Because lots of people I see who get very, very, very successful, and I think you are the future leaders of this world. I can just see it from the studying you do and that you come into the room here. Never forget that you have to reach down and help people. It's a really important thing that I don't take for granted. Going back to that school now, I know that those teachers didn't understand how to look out for an individual like me. I was obviously clever, I was obviously smart, but I was just misdirected.
Yeah.
I was frustrated, but they didn't see that. They saw that as rebellious and naughty, that something needed to be excluded. Going back now, after 15 years, I've still got some of the same teachers who gave me detention. It's very interesting now. I forced them to bring me reports. They have to bring me the stuff, right? So things come full circle. Yeah. So be careful how you pass people, because you never know where they might end up later in life. Never look down on anybody, because for unbeknownst reasons to you, you could be in that very same situation.
Yeah. Do you think that for entrepreneurs in particular, like, I've also noticed this, but like a lot of really successful entrepreneurs or executives or leaders, they typically have something that has happened early on that has somehow kind of shaped the way they see the world. Like, it's given them an extra hunger that maybe people kind of that didn't have the same challenges wouldn't have. So do you think that also played a role? And also, I think there's an important lesson there about like the power of mentorship, because the teacher who kind of took time to sit with you and like guide you in the right direction.
Yep.
I think like all of us need someone like that as well.
Well, I think all of us, I always put it like this. I'd always want to be the person who was remembered fondly.
Yeah.
I used to look at role models like Sir Trevor MacDonald, who plays music, but Sir Trevor MacDonald on the television at 10 o'clock. He was the only black newsreader that was on the television. He was always on time, he was never late, so it was always important, 10 o'clock on the dot. But it was more so he represented the qualities or aspirational elements of a man that I didn't have in my home life. Because my dad wasn't around, I was constantly looking for role models who reflected the person that I wanted to be.
Yeah.
At the time, music was very important to me, so I'd be listening to ballads about love and relationships and everything else. And that's kind of what I wanted to replicate in terms of the stuff I saw. I always ultimately wanted to be liked and honestly loved. Like I talked about, I didn't have that experience as a young man. So as a result of that, I always thought, if I can help people, they'll like me. So I did all things that help people. So I'm a people pleaser naturally, because I want my mum to tell me I'm a good boy. Everything in my life is about helping people. I'm motivated by providing things or systems that help people. So whether it's me as a governor at school or the founder of a business, the founder of a charity, everything I do is to try to find the young Tim who might need some help somehow.
Yeah.
So I've taken the crap that I had and not let that make me be crap, hopefully. I've helped it to inspire me to do things to avoid somebody else becoming bad.
I love that. So you've used that as a learning.
Huge.
To be able to...
I think we have a choice. Listen, it's inevitable that things are going to not always go well for all of us. Yeah. There's going to be something, you're going to fall over, trip, something's going to go wrong, your mood board is going to collapse, whatever it is, right? Your affirmations are not going to manifest. But you've got a decision then, what do you do? Like, I remember a very poignant moment, which sticks. I remember going to school one day and it was raining. And we had black trainers. And if you've ever had this, you'll understand what I mean. There was a hole in the bottom of one of my trainers. It was the left foot. I remember specifically, it was a left shoe, had a bit of a hole because it had worn through. I had these shoes for ages. And we put cardboard in the bottom of them, but because it was raining, it got wet. And with wet leather, you get white patches around the top, because when the leather dries out, you see the white where the water was when it dried out. And I couldn't tell my mum, because I knew she didn't have enough money to buy the things. So I was determined that I would never be two things. I would never have crap shoes and I'd never be cold. And that drove me in all the things that I was doing. So I was working hard to make sure I could buy any shoe that I wanted, any time I wanted, wherever it was.
Yeah.
I get shoes made for me now, because that is like a big thing in my head. Like, I need shoes that have no holes in them. That's a really big thing. And my house, it's the temperature of very hot all the time in my house, right? So this fuel crisis we're about to go through is going to mess me up in a big way, right? But because of those things when I was young, that's what propelled me to. My choice in that matter is not to hate the world or the people who may have done me wrong. It's to make sure that I could do things to avoid that for other people.
Yeah,
and I think we just have to realise that we are sent things for a reason. Mm. Like, the test that we are given And the reason why I pray is to give me the strength to deal with the bad stuff so I can go and do good stuff off the back of it.
Amen, amen.
It's really important because we have a choice. And the sliding doors moment is sometimes impacted by your own actions.
Mm. And there's always a learning that you can, or something you can grow in through those challenges, right?
Like, hugely.
Yeah.
I think your question was about entrepreneurs, and I went off piece ever slightly. I think entrepreneurs and intrapreneurs, people who work for businesses and are entrepreneurial, because I think we've put too much emphasis on the usual image is a man. International Women's Day was yesterday, so we have to make sure it's equal. But usually a man running off into the future, conquering the world by themselves, right? It's rubbish. It's starting a business is really hard.
Yeah.
It's really lonely and it often fails.
It's overly glamorized.
It's over glamorized. I failed so many times. My first business, I left from Lord Sugar's tutelage and my first business collapsed catastrophically within 6 months.
Could you tell us a bit more about that?
100%. You really want to dig out the scabs today, anyway. So I was working for Lord Sugar. I'd won the show. It went fantastic. My head was really big because I thought I could do no wrong. I was the apprentice. I worked for him. I smashed all my targets.
Yeah.
My job was to create a health and beauty business within Amstrad. It was the beauty division, which, if you know Amstrad products, was a very interesting concept, right? Anyway, I over-delivered on that. Mm. One of the benefits of my neurodiversity is that I have the ability to hyper-focus on things and not get distracted. Yeah. I will not sleep until I've done something. Right?
I've seen that.
I will... If I'm motivated, you're in trouble. That's all I'm saying. Right? If I'm motivated, you're in trouble. Anyway, as a result of that, and because I wanted the affection of him saying I've done a good job, I smashed all my targets. Within 8 months, we'd had the company up and running, a line and division in China of manufacturing our products and the molds of manufacturing the items, a call centre in Watford, a chemist here who'd made all this. Anyway, we'd done everything. So my contract, which was only for a year back then to work within his business, was extended to 2 years. So I was ecstatically happy. I was like, oh my gosh, I'm the man. I can do no wrong. Yeah. This is me. And ego is a terrible thing. Right. It's a terrible, terrible thing. Mainly because it makes you miss the blind spots. Mm. It makes you miss the blind spots because you become... The bigger your ego is, the narrower your vision is, and the less you are cautious about mitigating for things that might go wrong. Growing up through The Apprentice, I was always thinking what could go wrong and managing that.
Yeah.
But once I was in the position, I sat in my kingdom like, this is me. You're kind of arrogant. You miss all this stuff because you think everything's sorted. Anyway, I got to the end of it and he said, listen, Tim, you've done really well, but essentially we're not going to do this division anymore. We're going to do something else. What do you want to do? So I went away and had a thought and I was like, well, I've been doing this health business forever. I'm going to create a male version of this and I'll just put my face on the front of it and it will sell millions. I'm going to be a billionaire by tomorrow. That's what I said, right? Anyway, so I pitched him the idea. He said, okay, interesting. He gave me a deal, which I walked away with and I did it by myself. Yeah. Once again, the arrogance, right? I went out.
You wanted 100%.
I wanted 100%. Yeah, yeah. And 100% of nothing is, the mathematicians will tell us, right? You know. Anyway, so I started this company. I put a lot of money into it, built a wonderful website, which was the most glamorous thing in the world, but was crap because we had no products to sell. Developed a cosmetics line, did all the marketing strategy and was ready to go. I remember getting a phone call from a competitor saying, you do realise our marketing budget is about £500,000 a quarter. And I was like, wow, that's a lot of money. And I only had £100,000 that I'd put into this business. Because all the time, for the context is, back in the apprentice days, you got a job. And it was a six-figure job. And for somebody coming from Canning Town in East London, that was big money. But because I was so scared of this, I didn't spend any of the money. Like I had, but I should have had your wealth advice, right? The bare minimum just to live, I used, and everything else I hoarded.
Yeah.
I put it away. I hid it under the proverbial bushel and just left it there, right? And I think at the end of it, I had this £100,000 pot of money.
You didn't know what to do with it.
I didn't know what to do with it. And I put it all into this business, which was stupid. It was dumb because I should have got investors to give me their money and spent their money rather than mine. But I didn't understand how that worked. Anyway, so I put all this money in and I burnt through the money within 6 months. Wow. It was gone. And I remember I'd bought myself a very fast Suzuki Gixxer 750 motorbike. It was beautiful. It was blue and white. It was amazing. I had all the levers and everything. I was the guy. And I had to drive to Brighton on my last bike ride because I had to sell the bike. Wow. I'd run out of money and the business was collapsing. I hadn't told my wife, she was my girlfriend then, but I hadn't told my girlfriend. I hadn't told my mum. And there was all this pressure in my head, like, I failed. So I had to drive to Brighton and I was sitting on the beach. Have you been to Brighton Beach, anybody? It's not that great a beach. It's pebbles. It's hard pebbles. It's not that great. It's not crap because I like the people there, but it's not the greatest, right? It's not the Maldives. Yeah. It's not the Maldives, is it, right? Anyway, so I'm sitting on this beach in Brighton and I'm thinking, I've got no money now and I'm going to have to tell everybody that I failed. Like, how am I going to do this? And it was in my head, it was massive. And I was crying. I was sitting at a table crying. I had a bunch of muscle. I bought a plate of mussels. I wasn't that poor. I bought mussels. I was crying in this bowl of mussels thinking, how am I going to tell everybody that I failed? Because everybody sees me as the winner of The Apprentice, right? And I believe in that moment that I had a conversation with the Lord and he said, Tim, it doesn't matter. Mm. He said, it doesn't matter. And I learned two things from that experience, right? I learned two things. Firstly, I wasn't dead.
Yeah.
I wasn't dead. So I still had the chance to go again. Although I saw it as a failure, and it was a failure, I'd completely failed, like catastrophically, the worst possible way. I wasn't dead. Mm. I was alive. And that at that moment, I realised how much of a gift that was. And then secondly, I realised the power of asking for help.
Yeah.
Because what I tried to do, and this is a really important thing for all of us, what I tried to do is solve it all by myself. Mm. In my head, I tried to solve this problem. And I'd contained it in my head. And what I realised when I started asking people for help was that I was surrounded by people who wanted to help me, but I'd shut them out. I'd shut them away thinking I had to do it by myself.
Yeah.
And also, this massive problem that I thought was the biggest thing since sliced bread, the world kept turning. It wasn't that important. It wasn't that deep. No one had died, including me, and it wasn't that important. And that humbling lesson of loss, I think, was a lesson that I had to go through to calm my ego, to calm my belief that money was the only thing that I should be chasing, and to go again with something that was more substantial and more beneficial, yes, to me, but also to many others.
Sure, yeah.
So I built a business off the back of that. Very soon after that, I met another mentor, a guy called Paul Humphreys. I don't speak to him now, but he was an instrumental in my life at that point, who taught me everything I needed to know about business startup. He was one of the original founders of, what's the digital bank, the first one? First Direct. He created First Direct, one of the original ones of First Direct. Sorry, Revolut, I'm not offending you, but you know what I mean? There were others before, as it were, right? But he was one of my best advisors, and he helped me build a foundation called Bright Ideas Trust, which became a social venture fund. We raised about 4 million quid. We invested in 700 different companies of all young people who were on their way to create something. And many of those businesses were really successful, really successful. And I think if I hadn't of had that calamitous time, I wouldn't have created that business over there and been successful on the other side.
I remember you saying once, I can't remember what company it's called, but that you, through Bright Ideas Trust, you invested in a particular business, and I think it was like £10,000 or something, and then that turned into like a million pound business.
Oh my gosh. So that was two young boys from Hackney called Nick and Tom. I remember them. Tom is now an international DJ in Ibiza for running around doing stuff, and Nick is a property investor in East London. These two boys came to us. They dropped out of university because they got bored and they couldn't afford their maintenance, their living fees. And they came to us with an idea of importing fancy dress costumes called kigurumi. These kigu outfits were from Japan, where people would dress as animals and run around and do stuff. And what they were seeing at university, lots of people would have parties and they wanted to dress and look different.
Yeah.
And they were going to sell these things as these outfits, these all-in-one onesies to people. We gave them £7,500. And within 3 years, they'd sold that business for 1.2 million quid. And they took that money, they bought their flat, and Nick bought his DJ equipment and went around and did the stuff. That was one of the examples. We had a young boy who had just come out of prison, started a jewellery business, selling fake cubic zirconias to people who in the eras we grew up with wanted to look like they had bling.
Yeah.
And they had these big, like, fake earrings that hanging off their ears and chains and bracelets. But he took that business. We gave him, I think, £1,200 for a consignment. He's now got a shop in Hatton Garden selling real diamonds to very real people and turning over a lot of money, right? So all of these things, I think I would never have had an appreciation for these businesses if I hadn't failed my first business.
Yeah. Yeah.
If I hadn't gone through that thing, I would have had a very different view on what success needed to look like and what did I have to present. So that failure was a necessary lesson for me to go through to see how I could support other people.
What are some of the things that you look for when making an investment, and particularly for people who are interested in potentially starting their own business one day or joining a startup even, like in the early stage? What are some of the criteria you think about when making a decision?
We've got a framework. Our framework's very simple. It's a triangle. There's three things we look for. We look for what is the problem that this business or idea is solving? What is it solving? And is it a big enough problem that is not just past their granddad needing some help in the garden or something, right? So is it a big problem? And are there multiple people who are impacted by this particular problem? We then look at the solution that they propose for it and see if it's scalable and how quickly they can come to market. So if they haven't done it before, what would be necessary to get to an MVP, a minimal viable product, and could we scale that very quickly off the back of what we do? And then the final thing is, can they generate a profit off the back of it?
Yeah.
Because there's lots of solutions that are very expensive and don't make money, right? So it's what's the problem, what's the solution, and how much profit is involved in it? And if we can see those three things in the initial concept, that's enough for us to have a conversation.
Interesting. I'm just out of curiosity, how many people here are like interested in potentially starting a business, entrepreneurship? Sure.
Wow, lots.
Quite a few people.
Yeah.
Quite a few people. So,
I like that.
So I also want to touch on, because you touched briefly on The Apprentice.
Yeah.
And I think I want to focus on one...
Nick's getting excited now.
Yeah. one particular aspect, which is, first of all, how did that whole thing come about?
Okay.
And also, how did you stand out? Because I know for a TV series like that, there's probably like thousands of people that are applying.
Yeah.
And in some ways, the job market right now is kind of like
it's
that.
Very similar.
It's like people who are graduating now, they're having a really, really tough time on, like, how do they stand out? Everyone has a degree, everyone has a master's.
Yep.
So what did you do that made you stand out and actually get the show in, and you ended up winning the first series?
Yeah, great, great question. Yeah. And I like the connection to real stuff, because I don't like talking about apprenticeship in isolation, because it is not reality.
Yeah.
It's not a reality that many people go through. So I love the connection that you've made. Okay, so I was working for Transport for London. I'd taken the traditional route. I'd got the degree. My mum was ecstatically happy that I was the first Campbell to go to university, and I'd gone into the public sector. I'd done everything I was supposed to. I got the massive tick on the box from my mum's house, but I was bored out of my mind. I was in this job where I was essentially a project manager for Transport for London, dealing with things like the Channel Tail rail link that we now have, and also Stratford redevelopment. So it was before Stratford was built. So I was a project manager on one of those. I was earning a decent amount of money, 40-odd grand by the time I was 26. So I was doing all right, in comparison to nurses and teachers and other people. But I was bored. I would finish my work within the first 2-3 days of the week, and then spend the rest of it just daydreaming. And my wife, who was then my girlfriend, she sent me the application form for The Apprentice. She said, "Tim, I've seen this. I think you'd be fantastic for this." And I didn't know if that was a diss or that was a compliment. I wasn't too sure. I was like, what is she trying to tell me? Is she trying to tell me I'm crap at my job? I'm not meeting the criteria. What is she? I was quite insecure. Like, what is she really trying to tell me? Anyway, so I sent it because I was the graduate. I was my previous role before becoming a project manager. I was the graduate recruitment manager for Transport for London. I sent it to lots of people I'd recruited through the graduate process, and they all sent it back to me. Can't bother. It's too late. Blah blah. The day before the application closed, I filled it in. I was brutally honest in my answers. I didn't try and dress anything up. And lo and behold, they invited me for an assessment centre kind of thing. I was like, oh no, this is kind of real now. I've got to go, right? Anyway, so I rocked up at this assessment centre, and we still have the same process today, how we train people. or test people for the process. There's a hotel in Tottenham Court Road where you come along and it's just like an assessment centre. You come in, you have a preliminary interview, you go into a room, you're amongst other people, they ask you lots of questions and they see how you perform. And I remember rocking up to this thing because I went with very similar to how I'm just now. All I had is a blazer and a shirt, and, but jeans and trainers. And I said, I'm not... Just,
do you have nice shoes as well?
I had better shoes. No holes in these shoes. No holes in these shoes, right? I had a pair of Chelsea boots, actually. I'm obsessed with shoes. Anyway, we're moving slightly on from my foot fetish. We went in and I remember seeing everybody and there were people dressed in like two-piece suits and ties and bags. And I'm like, oh, this is not going to go well because I look like a man on road. I've just come in with my little Chelsea boots. This ain't going to work. And I thought, do you know what? I sat there and I was like, sod it.
Yeah.
I'm going to be myself.
What do you have to lose?
Yeah. More importantly, if I do lose, I haven't lost myself. Because I've just been judged by who I am. I haven't tried to make up something. Because if I get through as somebody who's made something up, I'm going to have to carry on that mask forever. And if they tell me no, actually, the Lord doesn't want me here.
Yeah.
He's got somewhere else that he needs me to be because I am who I am in his image. Yeah. Why am I trying to be anything else, right? And I think I had this pseudo-confidence. And it wasn't... I say pseudo because I was crapping myself, but I dressed it up as like, I'm just going to be who I am.
Yeah.
But I was really scared.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But it was easy to say I'm just going to be who I am because I could then blame everybody else and say it was their fault and push it out. But I was scared.
It's a nerve-wracking thing.
It's right? Very much so. So yeah. I'm always scared. I get incredibly nervous at talks, at speeches.
Even today.
Yeah. Like even now, I have to wear... I can't wear light blue shirts because I sweat. I get very sweaty and you'll see this big patch under my arm. Right? I'm like, what's happening here? So I don't wear light blue shirts. So that's why I got big jumpers on now, right?
Yeah.
But anyway, so I get really nervous because I'm not a great public speaker, but I've practiced lots.
Yeah. So there's that's a difference. Surprising to hear because you do like a lot of event facilitation.
I've spoken at big IBM conferences. Yeah. I've spoken in the middle of London at loads of stuff. I've spoken in front of thousands Bloomberg when you were there. Thousands of people. But when I did my first speech, I couldn't speak because my mouth was so dry. It was cotton wool. I literally was like, I couldn't articulate a word. But everything you do the first time is going to be rubbish.
So how did you get from that to now you're on TV, you're like doing interviews?
So what the apprentice taught me very clearly, because you've got to remember, I've gone in and TV is all about personas. So like in business, you'll build up a persona of a customer you're trying to sell to, same way with a television program. And the persona that I fitted was young, black, single parent boy from East London.
Right.
That was the box I was going to fit in. And on the other side of that paradigm was a very posh, white, 7 foot tall guy who went to INSEAD as a thingamajig who had boodles of old school money, proper old school money. So we were the direct opposites of each other, right? So you got to remember, everybody's going to put you in a box.
Yeah.
Everybody, within the first 30 seconds of meeting somebody, they're going to put you in a box. My learning from that experience is that I have the ability to do one of two things, live up to that label they've given me or show them who I really am. Mm. And that was a choice. And it's hard because it's easy to fall into the box where you must be this nice, demure person that because that's what we expect of you.
Yeah.
Because that's your heritage, that's your culture, whatever it might be. But it's much harder to own who you are authentically because you have to be slightly vulnerable. You have to make yourself vulnerable. And in that scenario, after the first 2 weeks, because I had to get through week one, I couldn't be the first one to get kicked out. That was the goal. I can't go first. As long as I don't go first, it's a win, right? Because if you've watched any movies, the black guy always dies first. And I weren't going to be that guy. I made it clear I ain't going to be that guy. I'm last into the credits at the end. I'm last into the credits. So I made myself a promise. Don't get kicked out first and do the best that you can to be authentic.
Yeah.
Because I knew that my boys and my wife would be watching. If I came out trying to be speaky-spoky and speak the best... Because my mum could do that. When the phone rang, she'd speak the best Queen's English in the world. Hello, how can I help you? I'm like, you don't speak like that, but what are you talking about? But she was learning how to navigate environments.
Sure, yeah.
Because when you're an outsider, you have
that's
to learn.
That's a powerful skill as well.
It's a very powerful skill. To be able to code or mask is a very powerful skill.
Room,
but the problem is, that is detrimental to your mental health over the long term. Because you have to live two different lives. And that's hard. And what I learned in Apprentice is that you can't be who you are until you have built up a power base of owning a space. What do I mean by that? Once I, on the first task on The Apprentice, I put myself forward as leader. I didn't really want to do it, but I looked around the table and I was like, the only way I'm going to get them not to see me as the poor black guy from East London is if I win. I have to win. And one of the good things about being from East London, I like fighting.
Yeah.
Figuratively. I love that. For the camera. Figuratively for the camera. But I like a fight. I don't mind a fight.
Yeah.
I'm not afraid of fighting my corner or defending my family or my people or things that I passionately believe in.
That's why
in.
You do martial arts.
100%, right? So in that environment, I realise I can fight better than these people because I'm hungrier.
Yeah, you have
I'm really hungry. So my skill, I can't compete with INSEAD guy.
Yeah.
Can't compete with him. Yeah. He's taller, got more money, he's got the back. I can't, but you know what?
Yeah.
I will work harder than him because I bet you he's never had a hole in his shoe. Yeah. I bet you he's, do you see what I mean? So if I can go to school every day with a hole in the shoe, I've got a level of resilience that he's never had.
Yeah.
He's never touched that. So we've all had things that no one else can have. And it's like, can you convert that negative into something that differentiates you from somebody else? Because when it's hard, I'm not worried because I've been cold.
Yeah, yeah.
I've had crap shoes. I've had rubbish clothes that have been handed me down from some thrift store. Yeah. I've had all that. So, and I never, and no matter what I have now, I'll never forget that young boy who didn't have anything.
Mm.
And when I'm challenged, that young boy comes out again. Yeah, I'm like, okay, we've got to go. We're ready. So I'm in that mode, right? So in that scenario, I had to go and put myself in a vulnerable position to win. But the second I won, they all had to respect me.
Mm.
Because the only way you can get to a position of authenticity is when you have something of value to exchange. And for many of us, the first thing we have is our education.
Yeah.
Because that's the leveler. It's the piece of paper where I'm just like you.
Mm.
And what you realise very quickly, it's not enough.
Yeah.
Because you've got the piece of paper and you're still getting looked over. So it's like, oh, what's this game? You lied to me. You said, go university, get the stuff. I did all that stuff. I got the top grades.
Yeah.
And you're still treating me like I'm an idiot. Okay, so now we have to learn another game. The power structures. How do you work the dynamics? How do you deal with the politics of a small P?
Yeah.
All of this stuff, right? But once you understand, so I innately understand how power works.
Yeah.
Because of the emotional trauma I experienced when I was younger, I can spot when there's a bully in a room.
Mm.
And I gravitate towards bullies because I like to bully them back. So, seriously, because I think you have to challenge people.
Yeah.
I hate, my thing around helping other people, I hate bullies, like with a passion. If you use your power in a negative way, that's my cue to go.
Yeah.
I will defend anybody who is vulnerable because I've been vulnerable.
Yeah.
And when I see that, I hate that dynamic. So in that scenario, get power, then you can go and be authentic. Because when work tells you bring your whole self to work, they're lying to you. They're not being honest. Because you don't want to see me in a string vest at Carnival coming to work on a Monday morning. That's not what you're asking for.
Or selfies on LinkedIn.
You don't want that. You don't want that, right? So you've got to remember, you can bring your whole self to work when you've got something to exchange, when you've earned the right to do so. So you've got to learn the game and then you can actually demand your output.
I think this is something I also noticed, which is the power of entrepreneurship as well.
Yes. Right?
Because everyone talks about being an entrepreneur.
Yeah.
Most of the businesses that start end up failing. That's not to kind of discourage anyone.
But it's a fact.
It's a fact. And I think something I've seen you talk a lot about is how you don't necessarily need to be an entrepreneur. You can be an entrepreneur 100%. And still make a lot of money and be super successful.
Listen, in the legal field, right, I'm telling you, I've seen some legal brothers and sisters earning millions with a paycheck. They get a paycheck every single month, millions. So this is the lie that we're told. Like, you have to go outside and start your own thing to get wealth quickly. And in the main, that is true in terms of, for most people, that is the way that you accelerate wealth creation, by creating some IP somewhere that you own and you turn into a business. However, for lots of people who work in lots of firms where bonuses are quite nice, you get your bonus and you're paying off your mortgage.
Yeah, UBS.
You see what I mean? So, listen, my wife's at PwC.
Yeah.
My daughter's at Accenture. I've worked in some very big organisations. Some of my best friends work in private equity. They ain't missing a meal.
Yeah.
And they don't, none of them are risking any of their own money. None of them have to worry about I can't take sick leave or I can't leave. They have the mandatory holiday requirement. They have a manager they report into and they're happy.
Yeah.
So I want people to do what is best for them. But there is a dignity in having a job, being wonderful here, but being an entrepreneur within a structured environment. Sure. You don't have to only create businesses by yourself. However, we are in a stage where with technology, and Alex in our background, we can create businesses in our sleep if we really wanted to. That is wonderful now. The barriers to entry are so low to create things now. Why wouldn't you have both? Mm. Because the dream that we were sold is like, work for 25 years, retire, and then die.
Yeah.
That dream's gone because now you're going to be working till you're 102. The 100-year life means you're going to live till you're 100 as well. So it's like, what's happening here? We have to think of a different way. So the side hustlers who do one piece of work for somebody else and it earns something on the side are the ones who are going to accelerate their wealth a lot quicker than others.
Yeah, I think that's so true. Like the barrier to entry now, it's like Alex gave a talk recently about AI and how most people aren't actually underutilize
100%.
AI and it can be utilized for so much.
I was saying before I came here, right? We've got a team of developers in Brighton, Bristol. Sorry, in Bristol, Brighton's my beach. in Bristol, we've got 10 developers, very smart kids, some from UCL and other institutions. That's why I laughed at the UCL things. They say with technology as it is now, their tech stack that they have, they are at least 10 times more efficient than they ever were.
Wow.
That is nuts. Like, these are bright kids in their own, and they're 10 times more powerful with the tech they have. So Peter Thiel, ex-PayPal, doing very interesting guy. His theories on life are very interesting. But anyway, that aside, he prophesizes that there'll be one person who will be able to create a $1 billion company. And wow. You can quite easily see it. I've seen, like...
Yeah.
There's a team in Japan. We were speaking to them the other day. They've got a room full of MacBook Minis. Full of MacBook Minis, all doing repetitive tasks.
Yeah.
And they're trading on the stock market 24 hours a day, wow, globally, making a lot of money. It's nuts. It is nuts. Anyway, we'll get past that. Yeah, but technology is an opportunity. But it's also something I'm quite cautious about because the humanity of us as a human race is not being... the ethics of it is not in line with where I think we need to be at all.
So on that note, and then we'll get to questions, there's a lot of people here who are maybe early in their career.
Yep.
Maybe they're thinking about transitioning into something else.
Yep.
When you think about the future of work, particularly given AI, what would you be doing if you were coming out of uni or very early in your career to future-proof your career, and how would you be thinking about like applications standing out in the marketplace, things like that?
This is interesting. So for me, it's timely because my son is 16.
Yeah.
So he's at this exact moment in time, right? He should be studying, but he's probably playing PlayStation or on some TikTok something, doing some nonsense. Anyway, so what I tell my child is what I would tell myself, right? So it's very personal and very honest in that regard. For Aaron, I think he needs to go off and do an apprenticeship and do something vocational, which underpins the technological drive that we're seeing everywhere else. Because if you're not going to be in technology, you should be supporting the long chain of technology. And we know there are a number of challenges with regards to powering technology and the environmental impact of technology. So I've told Aaron, I will support him with whatever he needs to build an electrical company, where he's out becoming an electrician and getting the trade, the Pimlico plumbers of electricians.
Yeah.
Because if Aaron can sort out electrics, he'll never be poor. He'll never be poor because all of us, the new Maslow needs is Wi-Fi and power. It's Wi-Fi. When you go to a place, what do you ask? What's the Wi-Fi code?
Yeah.
And can I plug in my charger? Do you see what I mean?
Yeah.
That's the mainstay, right? So for Aaron is not academics comes relatively easy to him, but he hates it. He's like his dad. He can't sit still. He's really bored. I can easily see Aaron having a fleet of cars that charge an extortionate amount of call-out charge when the electricity needs to be fixed.
Yeah.
That's what I could see Aaron doing. What I'd say to my daughter, very different. Studious, diligent, perfect first child. And then we got convinced to have another one, and Aaron came home and he's like me. He's my doppelganger, right? What I'd say to people who are more studious is to get in touch with project managing technology, because the technology piece is going to happen anyway.
Yeah.
What people are going to have to do is, how do you plug it into legacy stuff that exists? Where's Lloyd's of London? The legacy stuff that exists now. How do we make new technology talk with old ways of working? Mm. That's where money is. Actually, there's a guy called Chris Donnelly. He's a very interesting entrepreneur, really good guy. He said, whatever you do, and this will be important for you as university-minded individuals, think about the consumer trends that are impacting any given market any one time and following that comet trail. So at the moment, everything is focused on a number of interesting things. Aging demographic. So we're not having as many children as we were before. So things in social care are going to be very important, because if we all live to 100, God praise it, might happen. Who's going to look after us?
Robots.
Yeah, well, if we're going to have robots wiping my backside, that might be quite good. But who knows, right? Yeah. But what we have to think about these things, right? That's a trend that is real now.
Yeah.
If the post-Luddite environment we're in now, there was time to acclimatise to what technology, new technologies were coming on.
Yeah.
So that the steam engine, the bridges, they took long time to decimate old industries.
Yeah.
This wave is very quick. So what do we do with all the people who want to be lawyers, who train to be paralegals, but there's no need for them to go and do case research anymore?
Yeah.
What do you do with all those entry-level positions or graduates or smart? What do we do with all of that resource? Because have you seen a cartoon with Wally? Yeah, what one of the best future predictions of world in the I've ever seen, right? We're all going to be sitting around on floating on things, pressing things to bring us. It's happening already though, because DoorDash and
delivery.
It's now like I could lock you in your room and all you'd need is a credit card and you could live.
Yeah,
you wouldn't have to leave ever again. Mad. And that was a film, but it's real, right? Yeah. So what do we do around people who don't have to leave their houses anymore? So you've got to be thinking about these consumer trends, because the big fight that's happening at the moment is that you've got the East and the West fighting for dominance around who's going to own this AI space and who's going to power this AI space.
Right.
So the US wants to do the power, and you've got Asia wants to do the technology.
Yeah.
Europe is dead in the middle. Quite literally dead, because what is it offering? Yeah, they want to try and regulate, but it'll be bypassed. It's not going to. What is Europe in the middle offering? What does it have to offer? So you kind of have to think about these things now, because you are that future, right? So, what of those two fights are you going to do? I had great hopes that places like Ghana and Nigeria and big places in Africa were going to be the savior, because they're the only ones that are growing
the population going up there,
and it's young population. Yeah, yeah. So it's the old decrepit Europe wants that number. They want that number. So Keir Starmer's soon going to tell us to all have children. Seriously, you think it's a joke? Watch, be very minded. Governments around in Europe are going to start encouraging people to have children, because there is a big worry that we are not going to have enough people to be effective. Because our position, our soft power, is useless in this arms race that we see happening, right? So unless you look geopolitically around what's happening, unless you read The Economist alongside the Daily Mail sidebar of shame in terms of what's happening on Love is Blind and everything, right? We've got to be really clear that these things are happening now.
Yeah.
And you've got to position yourself. How can you contribute positively to these changes?
Mm.
Because otherwise, the change will happen to us.
And how do you personally use AI in your own kind of day-to-day? And also, how do you keep at the forefront of what's happening and going on?
Yeah, so I spend lots of time at universities. So I'm always in Imperial, having big conversations with their teams. I love universities because they're a hotbed of two of the most important qualities that I think we need in life. Young people with infinite energy and no fear. No fear. I'm afraid of everything now.
Yeah.
I get up and I'm like, is my knee going to collapse? Where's my insurance policy? I'm like, I'm afraid of everything. I don't want to lose stuff. I've got too much now. So I don't want to... I'm no longer an entrepreneur anymore. I'm a risk mitigator. Mm. That's what I am. I'm a risk mitigator. I'm like, what is going to happen for my family? I've got to make sure they're okay. But at this age, and I make an assumption, a generalisation, you've got infinite energy and a lack of fear. You should have a lack of fear because you could try again.
Yeah.
My timeline to resurrect from failure is too short now to take big risks. I can't take big risks because there's not enough time to catch up. As I approach my 50th birthday, I can't.
Yeah.
I'm thinking about I need to retire. It's Botox, don't worry. So it's like, I haven't got time to take, but you have. You could try something today with an AI startup or an LLM and pitch it as your big thing. It could fail next week and start again. There's a great book called Failing Fast. You should read it. It's really important. Just go out and try lots of stuff and then see what works for you and be guided by your heart as well as your head. When I was young, I had to just be guided by my head because my mum said, go and do this. Yeah. This is the safe way to do stuff. Don't be safe. You don't have to be safe. Do what you really care about. And how do you find that? Find out what you spend most time doing outside of being paid. Mm. Think about what you spend most time doing outside of being paid. And in that, there will be a business model, I guarantee you.
Yeah, I remember seeing somewhere like the world's biggest problems also the world's biggest business opportunities.
Facts.
And like some of the problems we face on a day-to-day can be...
I think Warren Buffett said something like that.
Yeah, it can be turned into businesses and solutions.
100%. If it's annoying for you, it'll be annoying for another 10 people, then another 1,000 people, then a million people. It'll be fine.
Okay, I want to open it up to all of you guys. So, go ahead.
Two questions, if I may. So, first of all, you mentioned about sort of side hustlers.
Mm-hmm.
I heard from a few investors that usually they wouldn't necessarily have as much confidence in somebody who already has a job and isn't willing to give it up to start a business. What do you say to that? And second of all, if somebody were to want to start a business, what would be the path to seek investment?
Cool. I disagree totally with the first bit. And the easiest way to get investment is to prove through your side hustle that you're generating some revenue. So what I like, and lots of investors that I co-invest with and stuff, is that we like to see momentum. I hate to see business plans because an LLM will drill you up a business plan in 2 seconds and it will look fantastic. The spreadsheet will be perfectly accurate. But every single spreadsheet of any business that I've ever seen on day one never looks like day one in real life, right? So it's not enough anymore to write a good plan. What you need is some momentum behind that plan of where you've done something, when you've got some skin in the game that proves it's actually real. Have you sold to a customer? Have you built a prototype? Have you developed the website and got a waiting list of 5,000 people waiting eagerly to come through? You have to show some form of momentum that goes beyond the writing of an easily to generate business pitch, because that used to be the entry point. How good is your pitch? But now, Claude will drop you out a pitch in 2 seconds every day and it will sound wonderful. It will have the best language and it will take out all the M dashes and you'll convince them that you wrote it yourself. It means nothing. Unless there is evidence, you're not going to get any money now. So people want money. So what I would say is, and this is honest advice as somebody who really cares, never leave your job until your side hustle is generating more money than what your job was, because it's not, and that can be manipulated in a number of different ways. You could become redundant. You get a package. You got 6 months' money. Okay, we're going to give 2 months before the money runs out to test our particular idea. We're going to do 9 to 5 paid and 5 to 9 on our startup. That's the way they do it. So when you think about all the big startups, most of them did it in their garages while they were doing something else, right? Yeah. This horrible story around give it up, throw everything into one basket. It's rubbish. Mm. It's a con. And with technology, you don't have to do that now. You can. So I know I've got a consultant friend. He's a project manager. He will remain nameless. He has 3 jobs. He's got three jobs at the same time.
Do they know about it?
They don't know it. Three people are paying him. He's going to get caught. He's going to get caught. But he's got three jobs. And he's able,
he's
with
using
technology...
AI agents to do some of the stuff.
You think it's a joke? It's mad. He has three jobs. He's being paid by three different companies.
HMRC are probably wondering what's going
on. Seriously. It's nuts. But the thing is, it's all, he's meeting all his requirements. He's doing all this. He's got three jobs. That's his hustle. Nuts. But anyway, don't do that. Don't do that. The point is that the entrance into a business should be that you've done that triangle piece and you've proven it. Because the reason why the triangle is really important, it creates this flywheel, right? If you understand what the problem is and you really clearly articulate it, you will also know who suffers from that problem. So you can draw up a very clear persona about the person, their disposable income, where they congregate, how you're going to advertise to them, what your prices should be. There's a whole range of assumptions can be made once you really clearly understand what the problem is and who suffers from it. Then you have to be ultra clear on what your solution is. And that is about the competitive environment that you are. So why is your solution better than somebody else's? What is the people who are suffering now? What are they doing around solving this? And why is your solution going to be better? And the biggest competitor to any idea is inertia, because I could just carry on doing what I was doing or do nothing at all. So how are you going to convince people to that your solution is the one they need to come through? And most importantly, they're going to put their hands in their pocket and give you money for it, which leads on to the third piece is what is your business model? What is this mechanism that allows you to procure your elements to solve the problem and charge a premium beyond what it costs you to do? Because if you can't do that, you're not actually running a business, you're running a charity. You're feeding into it rather than it feeding into you, right? So that's why when you're in somebody else's company, it's amazing the amount of time that you can carve out for yourself, because job descriptions are quite rubbish.
Yeah.
And if you're really sharp, you can get rid of most of your tasks really quickly and not be stretched as they want to do, right? So if you know the way the antiquated work system works is that somebody up here delegates to somebody down there, who delegates to somebody down here, delegates to somebody down here. And all you have to be able to do is make sure that whatever you're given can be done in less time than they expect it to be done. And then you have a choice about what you do with your other bits of time. Does that make sense? So in Germany, the culture is very, very, very different. If you're in the office beyond 5 o'clock, you're getting sacked. Like, what are you doing? Like, we gave you enough time to do it. You should be home. No one's staying late. It's like we were efficient. We get stuff done within the time frame, move on. We have this tendency to think that I have to put my jacket on the back of the chair and be the first one in and the last one out. Madness. Mm. With technology now, I get my work done quick. I'd finish my work as quickly as I could and not tell them that I need new tasks and then do the stuff that I want to do. Your time is your time. But we are so subservient. We're waiting for people to tell us what to do, how to do it. Don't do that as a doctor, please. Don't rush my... take your time. Take your time. Make sure you're thoroughly done. But you know what I mean? There are certain disciplines which facilitate you being able to make time out of nothing. So if you can do the first... I would always advise somebody, get somebody else to pay for your dream. If someone's going to pay you a salary that you can use your weekends, your evenings to build up your business before making the big jump, it's a sensible risk mitigation strategy. And investors will give you more money if you've shown skin in the game. So you put your own money in, you've got your own support, and you've got customers who are engaged and paying. That's the easiest way to get money now. Don't think it's enough. The amount of people send me a business plan, oh my God. And what do I do? I stick it in chatty. And then they tell me it's crap, and then I send them a reply back. If you've done that to me, I'll do the same to you.
Yeah.
It don't mean nothing. But if you come there like, Tim, I've made five grand in 2 weeks off of a TikTok shop, I'm like, oh, so we've got a channel now, we've got a customer, we've got some data, oh, now we can create a flywheel. Because if you could tell me your cost of acquisition of a customer is this amount, I need to give you this money, and that's going to there. And please don't put in your pitch decks you're going to use Facebook or social media for advertising or buy an influencer. We're going to do Gymshark. Dead. Dead. Move on. We've got to find new ways. Say you're going to build an agent who's going to scrape data.
Yeah.
And then get like, do you know what I mean? Come with something. everything in my life has been about being an anomaly. Being an anomaly. Oh, the poor black guy on the television, anomaly. Okay, you're going to stand out. That's what we're going to use it. Your business plans have to be the same. Every job I've ever got, every promotion I've ever got, I've written a handwritten letter. Mm. Because who gets handwritten letters now?
Yeah.
No one. I wrote a letter to a woman the other day. She was like, Tim, oh my gosh, you wrote me a letter. Yeah. She was so gassed. So gassed. I forgot how to write, but she was gassed. She liked it. It was amazing. But imagine if you receive something that nobody else has done, you're going to remember that person. So you've always got to, it's the key thing is sales. I love selling because I love the buzz of winning. It's a win. It's a dopamine hit. My ADHD was dope. If you can think, how can I beat everybody else? That's the way you're going to do it. Think differently.
For the sake of time, I think whoever else has questions, we'll kind of group them together. Yeah, so we'll go.
Yeah. I'll keep the answer short as well. Sorry.
Cool.
Yeah, thanks for the time, Tim. Really enjoyed that.
Cool, brother.
I'm going to keep this quick.
Yeah, man.
My question was just about the hunger you had.
Yeah.
Just now that obviously you're living in a different environment, how do you maintain that? And also perhaps with your kids?
Great question.
Okay, hunger. Who else?
Just that, Nick?
Alex? Yeah.
Oh, okay.
I mean, it's quite a different topic. It's still with AI. Mm. Yeah. So I work a lot with AI.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Product and project roles, all these people, they're not going to be learning the skills we are afraid that they need in order to make it to the next level.
Yes.
Right? So the critical thinking and so on, because the AI is going to do all that stuff for them. That's what we're building.
Yeah.
I don't know if you have thoughts on that.
Okay, so AI, critical thinking. Yep.
This is more of a statement than a question.
Mm.
You mentioned Africa.
Yep. Yep.
That will be the main funding for AI, because without those, you can't really work electronics.
Great point. The only challenge is that most African resources are not owned by African nations.
Yeah.
Mm.
It's not the sources.
So if there is a nationalization of African continents, it could be very interesting for Africa. But that's going to take a lot of unwinding of old school thinking, which I'm not optimistic about. Yeah.
Alvaro, oh sorry.
Yeah. I know it. Yeah. It's very clever what they could do, but it's I hope. I'm not very optimistic about capitalism.
Yeah. Now I want to take that conversation offline. Yeah, I have many thoughts on that. Alvaro, yeah.
So for me, it's sometimes you can find education lacking.
Yes.
Despite of how full it might seem.
Yeah.
How can someone fill in the gaps, especially pointing towards an idea, or just having that spark of curiosity that makes you go beyond 9 to 5?
Yep.
And then when we're in that position, how does one prepare himself to be a founder or to join a startup?
Okay, cool.
Anyone else?
Yes.
Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, thank you very much for your time, Tim. In your opinion, what are some of the most important skills and experience when you start in developing or to then be successful?
Okay, yep.
Yeah, and we had one final one there.
When you're investing into a business, what do you consider more? The strength of the idea, i.e. the problem they're solving, or the strength of the founder? So maybe the idea is not that good, we think to ourselves, this person couldn't really get in the future.
Cool.
Okay, so there's a couple of key themes there. So one is hunger, how you find that, how you develop that.
Yep.
I guess that kind of somehow links a bit into like finding a gap in the market, filling that. And also Junior's question there, which was about founder versus idea.
Yep.
Yeah.
So hunger. This goes into the question: are entrepreneurs born or made, right? And I think environment plays a huge part in creating entrepreneurial activity. innovation. My mum was entrepreneurial, not because she was super clever, because she had to. Necessity is the mother of invention, right? That was not an accident. So I think any one of us who receives a tap on the shoulder, you're redundant, and it's a possibility in the portfolio careers that we're all likely to have in this very interesting job market. We'll have to think, what do I do if that happens? And you have a choice. Am I going to sit down on my backside and do nothing, or am I going to come up with an idea? So I think the hunger comes from, what is your North Star? And it might be that you want to buy a Ferrari. It might be that you want to fly on a private jet. It might be that you want to solve hunger in the middle of China, whatever it might be. So you have to find what your North Star is, take a picture of it, put it on your screensaver on your phone, so every time you open up your phone, you see it, and check yourself every day, am I moving closer or further away? I don't think it's a thing that just becomes about, is it in your DNA? I think it's nonsense. I think your environment dictates whether or not you're going to be entrepreneurial or not. That's your point. If you've had a bit of a hardship, then that might cause it. AI, I think the young people who are coming in are being taught to be glorified managers of AI. That's all they're taught, because what the leaders are seeing is that I need to take advantage of this piece of technology at the moment now, and all I need is bodies who have a bit more intelligence than others to be able to manage it through to where I want it to get to, which is not taking advantage of the amazing opportunities that are in front of us with it. What do we need to counter that? I think we need to get to a work experience kind of accelerator sausage machine almost, which takes every person through and open your eyes to the opportunities kind of thing. Because at the moment, AI is, to most people, nano banana doing nonsense, or a very weak rapper on an LLM kicking out Google research that look prettier than Google can do them at the moment, right? But if you framed it like when we were at school, did anyone do Young Enterprise? Yeah, Young Enterprise. What was the initiative where you got to start a business at school as a team, come up with an idea, put people in different positions, have a measurable goal, and then create something. I think if we had it where we said, okay, I'm going to show you, and we talked about this at the table today, every child in Africa can potentially have a doctor in their smartphone. That's what technology facilitates, right? Come up with a big, hairy, audacious goal where we can create a business using technology. Force them outside of the education system, which now doesn't want you to think, it just wants you to regurgitate information. So we're getting the fruits of our labour, essentially. We've got a system that says, the way I'm going to pick you to help me in my sifting of 10,000 people who apply for my job is, say, have you got a 2-1 plus university degree? I don't care what it's in, just 2-1. That gets you through my ATS system and does all the other stuff. But if we got back to the point where we said, part of your work experience is actually to create an AI startup, and there was no limits on that, we get back to what Saken... What was his name? Oh, he's died now. Oh, he's a wonderful man. Talked about creativity. Robinson. Ken Robinson. Wonderful. You are so clever. I love you, brother. So Ken Robinson, he talked about it. He said, young people have the power of every generation need, which is imagination. If you give us a 4-year-old a paperclip, they will come up with 10 million different ideas around the paperclip. If you give me the paperclip, you'll stick it on a piece of paper. Do you see what I mean? So I think we need to get people thinking more creatively about what technology can facilitate, because it really annoys me that we have this amazing tool here and people are still on TikTok every day. I don't care if you're on TikTok. That's up to you how you spend your time. But I can't sleep by how many exciting ideas I can bring to life now with the fact that I have technology. Yeah. I used to sleep 4 hours. I now sleep 3 because I'm up. Like, seriously, I've got all the major LLMs on my phone, and my battery's dead by like 12 o'clock, because I'm constantly like, okay, test this, test this idea, do this. We come back through. I've got now a virtual chief of staff.
Yeah, you were telling me.
Listen, it's amazing. No word of a lie. This is my virtual chief of staff, analyzes every Friday at 6 o'clock. It sends me a breakdown of all the emails that I've got, all the things that I need to do for the next week, and sends my PA all the things that I'm going to be doing in terms of my diary.
I love that.
It's nuts. But and I'm like, I'm better me, and I'm not clever. I'm not really smart. Imagine if these kids who are really smart got hold of this stuff. Everyone's talking about quantum computing and all the future stuff, but we've got enough now to make fundamental differences to what we do, and I think we should just do more of that. Anyway, I think it's a very interesting question. We could have that all day long. We talked about how do you become a founder, yes? Running a business is not for everybody. I'm really sorry. It's just not for everybody. It's really, really hard. Lots of people have the aspiration of wanting to be a singer. I'm one of them. In the shower, I sound the best. I am the best singer in the world in the shower. But I know I have not got the voice box or training to be anywhere near a microphone. It should not be allowed. It should be banned, right? There's a difference between what is your dream and what's reality. And I think what lots of people need to do, going back to your question, actually, Alex, my son goes to a really good school. My daughter didn't go to a great school, but my son needs to be going to good school because of his ADHD, and he wasn't really looked after by the system. Thankfully, by the grace of God, we had the means to do so. One of the first things they did when they took Aaron into school, they gave him a psychometric test to find out what he was good at. Mm. The difficulty with most state education, it says you've got to be good at everything. It wants you to be the jack of all trades. Spread yourself really thin and be good at everything. And the reality is that we're not good at everything. You might be better at things than I am, and I might be better at things than you, and that's okay.
Yeah.
But we live in this false reality where we could be good at everything. The reason why I have lots of agents running around doing stuff for me, because I'm terrible at detail.
Yeah.
I need to be reminded constantly about things that I've forgotten. The amount of tax bills that I've missed, the amount of parking tickets that I've had, the amount of bailiff letters I've had because I've forgotten just to pay something because it's not in my head. But now I have checks on this stuff, like my Dart charge payment goes through to think you haven't paid this, you've got to update. It saves me a lot of money. Anyway, you have to be clear about what is your thing? What is your thing of value? And it may be, in rare circumstances, somebody who's good as a technologist can also be good as a founder. But the skills of a founder, I don't have to know everything about what's going on, but I have to lead people. So I'm great at leading people because I'm the enthusiastic, energetic bunny who can say everything. I will make you believe that we could do anything. I might not believe it myself, but I'll make you believe that we can do anything. But that's my skill. And so therefore, I know, am I going to be the guy who's coding? No. Because I find it boring. I can't do it. But now Claude saves me from having to do all that, and Gemini makes my code look like better than anybody's. So it doesn't matter now. So you have to find what is your thing and why is that the right thing to be doing or leading. And it's okay sometimes to be number two, but be the best number two. Mm. But if you've got an idea that you passionately believe is better than anybody else's, go forth and do it. Rather than thinking about it, just do it. There's nothing stopping anyone from bringing their idea to life now. There's no excuse.
Yeah.
No excuse. Then it was about founder versus the idea. Idea always wins. Idea always wins. People will tell you that I invest in the team. Bollocks. Bollocks. It's the idea. Because if the team is great but the idea is rubbish, they have to go and find another idea. So why not find with the best idea? Does it make sense? It's nice, kumbaya. But the reality is this: is that to be nice is good, to have a great idea is better, because the synergy of the two together is better. Don't think of them as isolated things, right? So the dream of being taken under the wing of somebody just because of the strength of your personality is great. But you are better than that. You don't need someone. You should have the confidence to create something that's so compelling, it doesn't matter who you are. So in the wealth game, you will have people who have made a lot of money and will continue to make money for the rest of their life because they structure their wealth correctly. Doesn't mean they're any better than anybody else. They've just structured their wealth better. I know a lot of people who have made a lot of money who are right idiots. Seriously, Idiots. Yeah. The thing I had to get over very quickly is good always wins. Sometimes it loses, and it loses badly. Mm. It loses badly. But that's okay, because the path that that was going may not be the right one. I would always encourage people to be nice, be good, be wholesome, but I'd always encourage people to lead with a value exchange that makes a difference. And the value exchange that's going to make a difference, where people can't judge you based on your colour, your creed, your religion, or anything else, is if it's a good idea or not. Does that make sense? Because the bit that you then add on to that as the next piece, I'm a great guy. We love working with him. He's fantastic. Do you see what I mean? So I would double down into creating the great idea or doing the great work, and have that bit about your personality or who you are in your back pocket. Because I spent a lot of time in my early career wanting to be Mr. Nice Guy. And I was running around and I was a smiling guy. Everyone saw me as Tim's the Mr. Motivator. He's the happy one. He would want to make you laugh. And that was good until I realised that they weren't putting me in front of salespeople because they didn't have confidence in me. Because they saw me as the label, as the nice guy. Does that make sense? So I was living up to the wrong label. Mm. I didn't understand the game, as it were, because I felt, if I'm nice, the magic work fairy will come out of the thing and drag me towards the promotion. And in a corporate world, that's not how it works. You've got to be clear around what is the value exchange that you have that somebody would engage with you regardless of who you are. And then what's going to seal it and make sure they keep coming back is that they like you as a person. Does that make sense?
Thanks.
Cool. And then there was the one about the qualities. What qualities? Yes, I'm doing all right with my memory.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I'm doing all right today. I'm old.
Even I forgot about that.
Yeah, I'm old. I remember. So I think the key quality for people is resilience and adaptability. Mm. I don't think there's a magic skill to learn or whatever not, but I think if you are adaptable, where you aren't fixated on one thing and you can be flexible. Who goes sailing here? Has anyone been sailing? No one been sailing? Yeah, sailor. So yes, sailing. Everyone was ashamed. Like, God, I love sailing. Sailing is a wonderful activity. Do you ever go in a straight line in a boat?
No.
No. What do you do when the wind changes? You tack. You tack, right? You change the direction of your sails based on where the wind is going. And that's a key skill in life. Just like when you get on a plane, the air hostess tells you the best piece of information. If there's an emergency, you put your mask on first before you help anybody else. Get into the position where you are safe before you go and help anybody else. It sounds counterproductive, particularly given our faith, but you are in a better position to help people if you're in a strong, solid foundation. Yeah, yeah. If you're built on a solid base, right? Don't build your house on sand.
Yeah.
We are told these things, right? Anyway, so the skill of adaptability means that you don't really care what happens because you're flexible enough to move with the wind. If the wind changes or the wind slows down, you're right, I'm still going over here. I've got my point on the horizon where I need to get to. I've got my map, I've got my compass, I know where I'm going. And for us, that's our faith.
Yeah.
Our faith gives us that compass, that direction. We know, okay, if something looks sexy over here, it doesn't feel quite right because our faith tells us that's not the direction we should be going in, right? That's the bit where adaptability comes in. The resilience is that you are going to get punched in the face. I'm sorry to be the bringer of bad news. The world is not a pretty place. It's not a nice. People aren't all.
Everyone has a plan until they get punched.
Listen, and then you've got to check what happens, because when I got punched in the face, I was crying on a beach in Brighton in a bowl of mussels, and it was hard. It was hard. I can laugh about it now, but I was depressed. I was at my lowest point. I was like, you've got to imagine, everything about my personality was about winning. And I've lost. And I had to tell people, my nearest and dearest, that I've lost. And I've got no money. I have to sell my most beautiful bike. Yeah. That bike was my heart. Listen, my God, I'm going to cry now. The bike was so good. But it was material, but it doesn't matter. But it was still pretty. It was still very pretty. You will find out who you are when you have a bad day. And the resilience that comes from that, to your point about people being able to overcome and good entrepreneurs being from bad stuff is that if you've, I like to take people, I will never usually take people on a journey who have had a perfect linear career where it's all gone up. One of my first questions is like, what's the worst thing that's happened to you? What's the worst thing that's happened to you? Because if you could tell me how you dealt with that worst thing, I know more about you than when you've won. Winning's easy. Winning's easy. There's a thing called contextualization. I worked with a group that did a study of all kids who had left school. And Raphael, his name was, he said, what they found is that all the kids who left from private schools all came out with A stars and nines. They all came out with A stars and nines, and they were heralded as the most intelligent, great people. But when you look at the context, everybody gets a nine. It's not an anomaly. You're expected to get a nine because you're in an environment where everybody gets nines. But if you grow up in an environment where you're the only one who gets nines, you had to have something else that pushed you beyond what everybody else did. Because as humans, we like to conform. If somebody's doing better than you, you don't really want to show it. The people who go sailing, you weren't too sure about showing the sail because like, everyone get it. You see what I mean? You see the reservation. Like, that's normal because that's human nature, right? But if you can tell me how you overcome those challenges that everybody else who didn't get nines did, that's going to be the grit that makes you different. So adaptability and resilience are very, very important skills, I think.
Great. I think let's leave it there. Thank you.
Oh, wow.
We have a small gift from Netherhall House. This is a Netherhall tie.
Oh, wow. So, do you know what? Yeah. I'm going to wear it on the next series.
Oh, nice.
I'll wear it on the next series. I won't tell you when.
Yeah, yeah.
But
yeah. Probably on the NDA or something.
Yeah. No, it is like, fortunately, and the camera's still there. So, yeah, so I will wear it on the thing, and you'll be like, oh, we know that tie. Yeah. We got him. Is there cufflinks as well?
Yeah.
Oh, shut up. I love a cufflink. Look at yous. I'm very grateful.
I don't even have those.
We'll stop. We'll share. I'm very grateful. I love cufflinks. So that's a very nice gift.
So yeah, thank you very much. And how can people kind of see you? You're on Instagram and stuff, right?
Yeah. So the easiest way to get to me personally is via Instagram. Because I don't use LinkedIn because it's like full of people's cat's birthdays and all this other nonsense. I can't stand Instagram. It's so annoying.
Yeah. They're also bringing their full selves to work.
Yeah, now. Yeah. It's too much full self going on there. So the way to get me instantly, just send me a message on Instagram. I'm obsessed by that social media platform.
Yeah. You're doing really well on Instagram.
We're going to do some really good stuff on there.
Yeah.
There's a big piece we're going to do about the manosphere and challenging Andrew Tate world and other skits. It's going to be very interesting. I think men have got to do a lot of work about redefining their position in a modern society. In an environment where technology is at the behest of everybody, we don't need men who can bash bears over the head and stuff. So, like, what do we do? Where do we sit? And women have had lots of positive conversations about dealing with a patriarchal, misogynistic environment.
Yeah.
And we've been sitting there kicking around, doing sod all, scratching things that we shouldn't be scratching. So it's like, we've now got to think about how do we do more about redefining what it is to be a modern male without being emasculated.
Yeah.
Yeah. In a negative way. Yeah. Anyway, that's our next project. Yeah.
I mean, that's also partly why we do this like guest speaker series as well. It's like we want to try and help people think big, dream big, do stuff with
Go, don't be afraid of stuff. Fear and comparison crippled me as a young man. I always was looking at other people saying, oh my gosh, they're amazing. I wish I could be like them. Waste of time. My fingerprint is unique for a reason, so is yours. So just go and do whatever. And I wish I'd tried more things earlier.
Yeah.
So if you tried and failed today, like I was on the beach, no one will care.
Yeah. And no one will care. There's not much to lose.
No one will care. You can create a .com. On the weekend, I built a business. I started a business with my daughter called Our Sunday Dinner. It's called Our Sunday. It's going to be an intergenerational conversation about how you pass on culture to Caribbean communities.
Oh, wow.
And within an hour, Claude had built me the website. We had the Instagram handle. we'd set up a kit automation process of sending that email in an hour with my daughter. Like, if I can do that, and I'm not clever at all, you lot have all got bigger degrees than I could ever imagine. Imagine if we all said we were going to do one thing. It would be the best business in the world. Like literally, if we said we all, with all of our knowledge, we'd have an insurance policy, we'd have a banking account, we'd have AI agents, we'd have our wealth managers, you know what I mean? It would be the best business in the world.
Yeah.
So just try stuff. Just try stuff.